History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Just a few years after the end of World War II, America had lost its unifying spirit and became a fractured country. Foreign relations were fraught. There were suspicions that Russians were trying to interfere with elections for both Democrats and Republicans. Racism was rampant. Political parties were divided. And the person taking blame for almost everything that was happening was President Harry Truman. And there were jokes about him saying things like, "To err is Truman," and that he basically lucked his way and fell backwards into the presidency after FDR died and did a terrible job of upholding the office. Political columnist Fred Othman said, "The ballots haven't been counted, but there seems to be no further need for holding up an affectional farewell to Harry Truman in regards to the 1948 election. Truman's staff didn't think he could win, neither did his wife Bess. The only one that did think he could win was Truman himself. When he did win, people were shocked," and that goes back to the famous picture of Truman holding up the newspaper that said Dewey defeats Truman, because before the results were in, a newspaper printed that his opponent had in fact won when he didn't. Well, Truman oversaw watershed events, the passing of the Marshall Plan, the acknowledgement of Israel's estate, the beginnings of the Cold War, and setting the stage so there wouldn't be a violent nuclear confrontation with the Soviet Union. In this episode, I'm interviewing A.J. Baim, who's author of the book Dewey Defeats Truman, the 1948 Election and the Battle for America's Soul. I've come across Truman a lot in this series, partly because I live in Missouri, his home state, and I'm just a mile away from a bridge that he commissioned. But he's very interesting because he did accidentally fall into the presidency, but a lot of people today are arguing, both on the left and the right, that he rose to the challenge of that office. So we discuss his presidency, how there are parallels with today, but then we get into a discussion of what does it actually take to be a good president? What does experience even matter anymore when people are becoming president or running for the office who have no political experience whatsoever? Is political experience what it takes, or is there something else that matters? And what is that something else? So there's a lot to discuss about past and present. Hope you enjoy this interview with A.J. Baim. A.J., welcome to the show.
Such a pleasure to be here.
I am very excited to talk about Harry Truman. He has been mentioned many times on this podcast before, looking at Tom Pendergast and his patronage of Harry Truman. And here's a question I have I'm not quite sure of. Is he someone who is just cosmically gifted with luck, where he couldn't help but keep failing upward in life, from working at the local level in Jackson County, Missouri, up to senator, up to vice president, up to president? Was he cosmically lucky, or was he someone who did have some kind of reservoir of talent that he was able to tap into when he was thrust into the spotlight? What do you think?
I think without a doubt, the answer is both. This book that's out now, Dewey Defeats Truman, it's my third book in a row in which Harry is either the main character or an important secondary character. And really what it comes down to is the guy's story is inexplicable. If you were a fiction writer, you couldn't make it up, because the scenarios that thrust him into a seat of power are so extraordinarily unlikely. And yet, with each time that fate seemed to intervene and thrust this unlikely, ordinary person forward, he made the most of opportunities with this wellspring of talent that people really didn't know existed until they experienced it. And then really what it was he was a very moral person, and we can get into that because there's some gray area there. But he was a very moral person, and people respected his decision-making. But he was also very personally, he was a terrible public speaker, but on a very personal level, he was very influential the way he conversed with people. He could convince people when he talked to them one-on-one, or, you know, when he just behaved like himself, like an everyday American, which was something anybody could be inspired by.
Right. And if I had to compare another president who is incredibly lucky, I would also put George Washington up there. He wins battles that he should not have won, and that extends into his public life. But the difference is there's no sort of mystique surrounding Truman. The Harry Truman Library in Missouri is funny because it makes no bones about what you describe, this constant lucky stumble after lucky stumble. And I think one of the first biographies about him was called Tom's Boy Harry, about his patronage. But let's set the stage with what you're looking at with this election. So before getting into the particulars of the different candidates who are running for president in this election, What's going on in 1948? I think most people who don't know much about this period would think, oh, it's the afterglow of World War II. America is united in purpose, and we're now ready to take our stage as a colossus of the globe. But what are some of the challenges happening in this time?
One of the reasons why the story of the election is so amazing is everything that was happening outside of the electoral process. If you look at it, it's the early days of the Cold War. It's the early days of the atomic age. We're setting off these three nuclear explosions in the Pacific, the Sandstone atomic bomb tests that are not really a secret. They're reported on the front pages of the newspapers. You've got the Berlin airlift, the founding of Israel, the desegregation of the military, the launch of the Marshall Plan, the Truman Doctrine. All of these things are happening, even the beginning of the Red Scare, because the Alger Hiss, that original testimony happened right in the summer as the campaigns were beginning. So it's an extraordinarily exciting and scary time for Americans.
With the candidates themselves, tell me about the four that are running for president. I mean, they are very far separate on the ideological spectrum. Do you think today people talk about the 2020 election, where you have what could very likely be Bernie Sanders, who campaigned as a socialist, although with the Democratic Party, versus Donald Trump, who is much further with, some would argue, equal polarity on the right? Is there a similar type of dynamic in 1948, and how do you make that sense of it?
Absolutely. And the thing that's so exciting to me about the political spectrum of the different candidates, it's not just what they were doing and why they were doing it. It's the fact that the parties themselves were so much in flux. Because what you see happening in the first post-war election in 1948 is these parties trying to identify who they are, what they should be, what they should stand for. And it's changing. And what you really see in this instance is these parties beginning to find these alignments that leads us to where we are today in a really remarkable way. But, you know, you have Harry Truman, who is with, of course, the Democratic Party, and he takes over for Roosevelt. And Truman comes into office like a meteor. People have no idea who this guy is. And there's this huge question mark about his politics. He's from Missouri, and because of that, you know, he's sort of aligned with the more southern states. People are thinking that he's going to be more conservative than Roosevelt, and that people are kind of tired of the New Deal, and he's going to move the Democratic Party more to the center. And right after the war ends, he unleashes his 21-point program, and people are shocked because they find out that this guy, he's a real Jeffersonian liberal. He's a liberal. He's a New Dealer. And he's going to continue on with these very liberal policies, and he's going to fight for them. That's what the Democratic Party is going to stand for. Then the Republican Party, they have their own identity crisis. They have to figure out, what is the future of the Republican Party? So there's this ideological battle in the Republican Party between the right-wing people who are sort of controlling Capitol Hill. Robert Taft is probably, you know, the man they called Mr. Republican. Robert Taft was the center of that. But then you've got Thomas Dewey, who wins the nomination, and Dewey is really kind of a progressive liberal. He's a progressive Republican. He's a Teddy Roosevelt guy. So it turns out during the election that the Republican candidate agrees with Truman on a lot of the issues, and this becomes a problem for the Republicans. Then you've got, of course, Henry Wallace. Today you might consider him, I don't even know who I would compare him to today.
Like a William Jennings Bryan sort of progressive, or is that accurate?
Not so much. To me, Wallace represents this new move. If you, anything, you would say Robert La Follette, you know, who I'm talking about, who ran on a progressive ticket a couple of elections earlier. But Wallace is this guy who goes to Truman. He's Secretary of Commerce. He's a former vice president. He's a hero, a huge hero among liberals and intellectuals. And he bolts the party because he says that Truman is leading the United States to war against the Russians. And he goes out on a limb. He actually travels to Europe and goes on this lecture tour saying that the United States government is all wrong and that we should be more understanding of the Russians. And this kicks off an FBI investigation into Wallace's burgeoning campaign. Is he, you know, aligned with Stalin? Is he some sort of secret, you know, communist guy running for president? And he's an extraordinarily polarizing figure. When he campaigns through the South, There's violence at his rallies, literally violence, you know, fisticuffs, a stabbing. But when he ends up in New York City, in Los Angeles, he can literally pack stadiums. People think this guy is the savior. Then finally, you've got Strom Thurmond, who's the fourth candidate, and he's creating, he's also bolting the Democrats, and he creates the Dixiecrats, and this is all over one thing. It's Truman and his civil rights program. So after the war, Truman becomes convinced that he wants to be the face of a new civil rights movement. There's two reasons. One is Black America's, the vote for Black America is going to be more important than it ever has. And he thinks that if he can win this vote, it's going to help him a lot in the 1948 election. And he's not alone in that. Many of the candidates are courting the Black vote. But the other thing is, for Truman, it becomes a very much a moral issue. He thinks that this is what United States government should do. And the Southern, the Solid South, the Southern Democrats, bolt the party, and they pick their own candidate, and that's Strom Thurmond, who's the governor of South Carolina, and they run this campaign of unapologetic white supremacy during a time when many Black Americans are still fighting for the right to vote. Very controversial. And so that there you have it, four candidates pulling and tugging on the destiny of our country, moving it in the direction they think it should go.
And I'd like to touch on those two final candidates you mentioned, because even though one might look at them as bit players in this election, you could also look at them as the pure distilled versions of those Republican and Democratic candidates. So first of all, with Henry Wallace, something that was mentioned is that there was a secret clique of communists in the Progressive Party. What did that mean at the time? I mean, I could see someone from the outside thinking, oh, it's a Manchurian candidate, but that sounds a little bit too out there. Was it just people who simply had those political sympathies but knew that it wasn't politically popular, so they kept that hidden? Or what did that mean in the Wallace campaign?
Well, really what it meant was this. Wallace was going to get votes anywhere he could, and he was a hero among liberal intellectuals, but also the closest thing that the Communist Party USA could have to a candidate that they could actually back. The most obvious thing that they were saying about Wallace was, here's a candidate who's out there saying we need to do more to cooperate with the Russians. And this was very appealing to communists. So at the time, the Communist Party was not nearly as strong as it was in the 1930s, but it was still strong. And so you had some main figures who in the Wallace campaign who were very far to the left. You might call them fellow travelers, but were not really part of the Communist Party. Then there were figures who were. For example, the legal counsel for Wallace was a man named John Abt, A-B-T. And he later wrote a whole memoir about this, of how he, you know, he says in his memoir that he told Henry Wallace that he was a member of the Communist Party and so was his sister, and that it's going to be very controversial if he was part of the campaign. And according to Abt, Wallace said, no way, you're going to be part of this campaign. You're a legal genius. Your job is to get us on the ballot in every 50 states, in all the 48 states. But really what Abt explains, and this is also backed up by oral histories that are in the Columbia University Library, is that from the precinct level, they use the Communist Party's organization like tentacles to reach into communities in the U.S. where the party still had some, you know, vestiges of power, and used it to create a groundswell for Wallace, which early in his campaign really happened. And it was not a secret. So everywhere that Wallace went, he was asked about this. And he was firm. He's like, I'm not going to tell those people who they should vote for, and I'm not going to tell them not to vote for me. This is the United States of America. It's a free country. This country was founded on religious and political freedom. It's not against the law to be a communist. But you have to remember that this is occurring during the early days of the Red Scare and the Cold War. So very controversial.
Right. And I'm curious about Strom Thurmond with the Dixiecrat Party. On the one hand, it's easy to compare him to a segregationist like a George Wallace in the 1970s. But that's a very different thing, because it's sort of a last dying attempt to push back against the civil rights movement in the 1960s. In the 1940s, things seem pretty strong for segregationists, where Jim Crow is still in complete full effect. There's segregated bathrooms, segregated water fountains, and everything. I think Jackie Robinson happened in 47, and then with Truman desegregating the military is another factor. What animates somebody like Strom Thurmond and the Dixiecrats? Do they fear that the entire system of segregation is going to crumble if they don't push back now?
The answer is yes. But this is a very complicated situation. This is one of those moments in book writing and just the whole, you know, the way that we approach history, that we have to remember that the way people saw things at the time is not how we see them today. So I want to, I'm very careful how I handle this in the book, because it would be unfair to go out and just say Strom Thurmond, you know, he hated black people.
Uh-huh.
That's not the way it was. But the language he used, the pro-segregation speeches by today's standards are kind of shocking. You know, he's out there saying that we cannot have black people in our temples, in our homes, in our swimming pools. And when you think about it, you have to realize who this man was and where he came from. So, you know, I spent a little bit of time in the book talking about the history of this family, because the whole history of segregation in a strange way can be illuminated through the story of the Thurmond family. His father was actually politically active, wanted to be the governor of South Carolina, but he got in a bar fight and killed a man over a political disagreement. He was not charged with anything because it was self-defense, but it derailed his political aspirations. And his son grew up looking at his father like his father was the greatest man in the world, and he was going to realize his father's dreams. So his father ended up becoming chief legal counsel to a man named Ben Tillman, Pitchfork Tillman, who was one of the early figures who really coalesced the Democratic Party as the party of segregation in the South. And at the time, due to all of these different laws after the Reconstruction, black Americans were no longer allowed to vote. And so when we talk about Strom Thurmond fighting against the civil rights movement and Harry Truman, he was fighting for what he believed, you know, was the way that a lot of his family and all of the South had lived for generations. So it's very easy to look at it now and be like, well, that's wrong. Segregation is wrong. But which, frankly, of course, I believe it to be. If I was there at the time, I would have been aligned with Truman. But it's important to understand where Strom Thurmond and all of the people who voted for him come from and where their ideas were coming from. He won 4 states. I mean, that's amazing.
Yeah, it's important to contextualize it to think, what explains this groundswell despite bigotry, which is definitely a part of it, but then what would allow something in the American psyche for this to be popular? So that's our main cast of characters. Just to touch a bit more on Truman from when he becomes president to 48, you mentioned his 21 points plan. He's surprising people with how he's governing because he seems to have much more spine than most would suspect. He's not just ticking out the clock on Roosevelt's term. What happens by 48 when almost everyone assumes that he's not going to win re-election? Why does he become so disliked? Is it his public persona or his policies or a mix?
I can tell you this. Everybody in America knew that the post-war years were going to be a struggle, but that didn't make it easier when it happened. So in my last book, The Accidental President, I spent a lot of time, and even before that, my book before that, The Arsenal of Democracy, talking about how during the war, the United States became this arsenal of democracy, joined business, government, and military into this one massive fighting force to create the tools and win the war. Now, the bomb made the war end far faster than anyone had anticipated. So here you have this new president who's 4 months in office, who never imagined he'd be a president, who had never gone to college, no college education, never been the mayor of a city, never been the governor of a state, never had the money to own his own home, was now the most powerful man in the world, who had to architect the movement from a wartime to a peacetime economy. So everything got messed up. I mean, everything went wrong. Labor strikes, meat shortage, housing shortage, inflation. All of these things had a major effect on everyday Americans' lives, particularly high prices. By the time you get to 1948, inflation is cresting and actually just starting to decline. And the economy, it turns out, is doing really well. But over the 3 years between 1945 and 1948, Truman just gets a beating. He gets a beating in the press. And it's almost savage when you read what people are saying about him every day. He becomes sort of a laughingstock, you know. To err is Truman, people used to say, and to err is human. And there was all of these, you know, quips like that that would be in the paper and the radio all the time. If we're going to have a comedian in the White House, said W.C. Fields, let's at least have a good one. So by the time 48 comes, everybody just assumes he's washed up. And that sets the stage for this amazing election.
Hey, everyone. Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. This is a little bit of a side, and this could be speculation, but since you study these things, hey, why not speculate? I wonder if it's harder to be a good peacetime president than a wartime president, because transitioning from a wartime economy to a peacetime economy, that's a struggle. The sense of unifying purpose that would unite everyone in a nation together in a war, now that's gone, and all the squabbles that consume daily lives are back. Do you think that there's any merit in that idea?
I think that's actually very astute. What you just said is very clever and very true. And I'll give you an example. One of the things that really helped Truman, well, let me tell you this, let me put it this way. The Berlin blockade, on the very night in June 1948, the Republican National Convention, when Thomas Dewey is nominated as the Republican candidate, the Soviets blockade Berlin. And there's this absolute panic. So here you have all these people living in Berlin who have no access to food, water, coal. Anybody who wants to go in or out of Berlin has to travel through Soviet territory. And so Truman, it wasn't his doing, but he presided over the Berlin airlift, which captured the imagination of the world, saved tons of lives, and enabled us to confront and sort of defeat, if you will, the Soviet juggernaut that was terrifying people. And all of that was happening during the election. I think people, that really helped his standing, because people saw this man as a guy who was going to get things done, who was going to stand up to evil. And it really helped him. So you see how that answers your question? It wasn't really a wartime situation, but it was close. And this is what made it so exciting, you know, to write about, because it was, as the campaigns are unfolding, we're as close to World War III as you can imagine. And Truman is writing about this in his diary and in letters to Eleanor Roosevelt and talking about it openly. And that really helped his standing, that we were able to confront that situation and come out on top.
Something you point out, now let's turn our focus to the 48 election, is you point out some of the similarities with what's shaping up to be in the 2020 election, where there's impeachment headlines, talk of Russian collusion with different political parties, president fighting with both Congress and the press. What does that look like in 48 when things are coming to the election?
Well, thank you for asking that question, because that's the reason why I wrote the book.
And very well timed, by the way. So good job.
Well, thank you very much. But the degree to which the story is relevant to our political climate today is uncanny, to my mind. And I'll give you one example. I was researching the Dewey papers at the University of Rochester. And you know, when you're doing this, you're sitting there by yourself for 8 hours, and it's expensive to be there. So you're doing, you know, you're working as fast as you can so you can see as much material as you can. And it's stressful. And in the middle of it, you're absolutely silent. You're not allowed to really talk. And you're going through all these papers, thousands and thousands of pages that aren't helping you. And then you find the one page that is, you take a picture of it, and so on. And at some point, I found this memo, this Republican National Committee memo, where this writer is talking about his fears that the Soviets are going to meddle in our election. I'll read you a quote from it right here. "The Kremlin will sponsor political disturbances everywhere it can throughout the next 12 months. It will try to influence the result of the 1948 election by every means conceivable." And I was able to, through my research, drum up plenty of stuff that both the Republicans and Democrats in 1948 were sure this was going to happen. The Republicans thought that the Kremlin was, that Soviets were going to help the Democrats win, and the Republicans were sure that it was going to be the other way around. So they were, but that's just one example. And You know, in one of my talks recently, I showed a picture of a Ku Klux Klan rally, because racism is a big theme in my book. And then I showed a picture of Charlottesville. And the two pictures looked almost remarkably similar. You know, right-wing white voters carrying torches at night. And then, yes, impeachment headlines and fears of collusion with the Soviets and all these other things. To me, it's uncanny. Truman once wrote that the history of the world has moved in cycles, and very often we find ourselves in the midst of political circumstances which appear to be new, but which might have existed in almost identical form at various times during the past 6,000 years. And it's sort of a thesis of mine that what was going on in 1948, all of those themes that Americans were sort of dealing with while they were deciding who they were going to vote for, they're all back again.
I have to imagine that if you're a Russian, it has to be gratifying that Americans think you're such great masterminds that you could manipulate every single election for the last 80 years. It's, I don't know. I would imagine it'd be like if you're Jewish and reading the protocols of the elders of Zion, thinking, wow, well, that's very kind of you to think that we control every institution on earth and all, you know, 8-10 million of us control every bank and everything. So not true, but it's kind of you to think that in your own demented way.
And it's not often in conversation that people allude to the protocols. It's, I love that.
Yeah, I study Middle Eastern history. So, well, anyway, it's an interesting area. But I wonder, when you notice those commonalities between this 1948, 2019, 2020, the period we're in now, do you think it's coincidence that there are factors here that are lining up, or there's some deeper structural happening that's causing some of these similarities to emerge?
I think that all of these are deeply, deep-rooted situations in our political makeup as a national identity that come and go and come and go and come and go. Sometimes they're with us more than others. And I'll give you an example. Today, we still talk a lot about our relationship with Israel, right? We talk about where our embassy should be. We talk about how we are going to have good relationships with the Arab populations in the Middle East and still have a strong relationship with Israel. How are we going to balance that? How are we going to talk about having this relationship with Israel at the same time Middle Eastern oil from, say, Saudi Arabia or whatever is very important to us? So how are we going to keep those people from selling us their oil at a decent price? And these are exact situations. This was happening. In fact, of course, Israel was founded in May 1948. So this was a situation that all the candidates were dealing, exactly the same situation. Should we recognize the new state of Israel? And if so, what should our relationship be? And some of the most fascinating, when I write this book and all my books, I try to write these scenes in a way using all the documentation I have so that the reader can hopefully feel like he or she is in the room and feeling what the characters are feeling, so to speak. And one of the things, to me, some of the best scenes in this new book are Truman sitting in the Oval Office and meeting with his cabinet, and Jews are emigrating to Palestine, and they've declared that they're going to create their own nation. And the Americans are trying to figure out in the White House, what are they going to do? And the Secretary of Defense, James Forrestal, the State Department, are adamant that we should not have a good relationship with the Jews, that we should not recognize the new state of Israel, because they thought we were going to have a war with the Soviets, and it was so important that we are able to have good relationship with these Arab populations who are selling us their oil. Without that oil, we're going to lose the war. And at the same time, they were insistent that the new Jewish state could never survive without military and financial support from the United States of America. And we weren't necessarily, you know, able to do that if we had a war with the Soviets. So we're going to be protecting Israel at the same time. How are we going to do that? So it's just one example of how the situations we were dealing with in 48, it's almost identical. It's uncanny.
When it comes to the election itself, you mentioned that nobody thought that Truman would be able to win re-election. Maybe his wife, almost nobody. He is completely expect to go down defeat. And that goes to the famous picture that's on your book of Truman holding up the newspaper that says Dewey defeats Truman. When it comes to the actual election itself, what to expect when they're going in, and how does Truman win?
Well, It's not an easy answer to question. In fact, it takes several pages. At the end of the book, I do have this whole section where I said, well, what actually happened? And for Truman, when he found out he won, the first thing he said is labor did it. Labor unions had helped him win the election. Dewey was insistent, and the way he wrote about it in his letters to his family and his friends after the election, in letter after letter, he said it over and over, is that farmers did him in. Farmers traditionally voted for the Republicans, and they didn't. They voted for Truman. Why? Because Truman had come up a farmer, and there's some other more complicated reasons. But the fascinating part about it, to me, is the absolute excitement that really enveloped the Truman campaign in the last 3 weeks of its existence. And all of the documentation exists, so you can really dig in and bring it to life. For example, the library, the Truman Library, has dozens and dozens of oral histories of people who were on the campaign train. Margaret Truman wrote a memoir. She wrote a biography of her dad. She wrote a biography of her mom. And she kept a diary during the election, which I have. So all of these kinds of, plus the regular documentation that the president was, that was crossing his desk every day. Through all of that, you can really bring to life the excitement of that campaign in the last 3 weeks. And really what it came down to was Mr. Truman himself. He won the election through pure determination, charisma, and confidence that what he was fighting for was the right thing, morally and politically.
What were specific things that he staked his claim as being the moral choice? Were they things you mentioned earlier, like desegregation or foreign policy issues? What did he do to set himself apart from Dewey?
Well, three things. Well, the question was easy to answer right up until the last four words you mentioned. So civil rights, support for Israel, which was very complicated. And also just the whole idea. He staked his campaign as a race not against Dewey, because, again, on a lot of these major policies, such as civil rights, Dewey and Truman agreed. But what Truman fought against was the Republican-controlled Congress, which was far more conservative, the 80th Congress. So he went on this amazing train tour into all of these tiny towns. Sometimes he'd be out there at sunrise, literally giving speeches in his pajamas. He was becoming a folk hero by being this man who went into these communities where politicians usually didn't go, small towns, and people would come from miles and miles, huge crowds in these rural places. And he would speak to them genuinely and explain to them that the United States government did not belong to him. It belonged to the people, the voters. The American dream belonged to them. He was a servant to them, not the other way around. And what they had to do was vote for their best interests. And basically, the way he put it was the Republican-controlled 80th Congress was going to always vote for all of these programs that were not in their best interest. They were going to be listening to the real estate lobbyists. They were going to be listening to Wall Street and big business. And Wall Street was going to benefit over everyday Americans. That was his message, and it worked.
The subtitle of your book is The Battle for America's Soul. So presumably it's a battle that was won. Spoiler alert, Truman did win the 1948 election. So I'm sorry if I ruined that for anyone out there. But how do you see that as a victory for America's soul and the positive outcome of this?
That's a very interesting point. And one thing, the epigraph, right? The first thing that you read when you open the book are two quotes. One says, every vital question of state will be merged in the question, who will be the next president? That's Alexander Hamilton. And then there's a quote from Truman speaking on October 25th, 1948, so less than two weeks before Election Day. And he says, it is not just a battle between two parties. It is a fight for the very soul of the American government. So that's sort of where that idea came from. That was him speaking. But, I wouldn't say. It's interesting to think of the election as a positive outcome. It was a positive outcome for Truman. And one of the really interesting Monday morning quarterback things to think about is what would have happened if Dewey won. And the copy editor I worked with at my publisher, Houghton Mifflin, she, in an email at one point, she said that she, you know, she was going to wear a Dewey hat while she was doing her work because she was a Republican, which I think is wonderful. But, you know, because these two guys, in a way, were agreed on many of the major issues, it's kind of strange to think about it as a fight for the soul of America, because really what it was Truman was fighting again against the 80th Congress. But if Dewey had become president, as everybody believed would happen, how would America be different? And that is just maybe not at all, maybe very little. It's an interesting thought.
So I'm curious what your take is on the legacy of Truman. What does he accomplish in the second term? But moreover, what does a Truman fan say today? It seems like he's someone that he doesn't have fans the way FDR does, where he was a folk hero for decades, and to those who grew up in the World War II generation and the Silent Generation. Truman, not so much. Although I did once have a guest on this podcast whose favorite president was John Tyler, the 10th president. So that's major points for originality right there. And I have noticed that in the C-SPAN presidential ranking, I think Truman's been creeping up over the years. So he seems to be getting some type of new recognition. And I think Charles Krauthammer, after George W. Bush left the office, he was a conservative commentator, and he argued that George W. Bush, history would see he did the right thing. And he compared him to Harry Truman, who had the same treatment. Who knows, will that happen or not? But yeah, so what happened in his second term, and what sort of the afterlife of Harry Truman for those that think he was a good president?
Well, I mean, the main thing that happened in the second term is Korea. And one point I can make is that Thomas Dewey and, surprisingly, Henry Wallace, both of them, reached out to Truman during the early days of the Korean War and said that they agreed with his decision. I mean, this was very controversial. Both of them, Dewey and Wallace, reached out and said, I would have done the same thing if I were president. But, you know, Truman had a rocky second term, and when he left office, his approval ratings were not good at all. And he went back and lived quietly in independence and went for his walks. And when he passed away, you know, he wasn't. But so why is it that he's been creeping up? It's so interesting. You know, you can go on YouTube right now and see a hard right guy like Judge Roy Moore on the campaign trail quoting Harry Truman, who was very much a liberal. How does that happen? Donald Trump, in front of the United Nations General Assembly, the first time he addressed the UN, I think, he quoted Truman. So why is it that all of these politicians, whether you're on the right, the left, or the center, why do they all love Truman? And I think the answer to that, there's two answers. One is that this was a guy who was like an everyday American. And so his ascendancy is something that any American can identify and dream about, because we all dream. Some people look at video of Metallica and dreaming of themselves playing guitar on the stage. And some people look at football and say they dream of themselves being the quarterback of the San Francisco 49ers. And this was a guy who achieved the highest levels of success, who earned everything about it. There was nothing of privilege in his early life that would let anybody believe that he would have achieved what he achieved, and yet he did. Now, the second thing I would have to say is that a lot of people look back on the history of our country and identify the Truman years as the last sort of era of true American greatness, when the moral leadership of our country could not be questioned. We were sacrosanct. We were always doing the right thing, or at least that's the impression. Once Korea came, things changed. And wars happened. You could never compare Korea or Vietnam to World War II. Anybody would say, well, World War II was truly a battle of good and evil and nothing else. It was that's what it was. But after that war, a lot of people look back on our country's history and see the identity of our nation changing and not necessarily in a good way. So the Truman era is remembered as this sacrosanct era. That's my theory anyway.
Well, one last question to tie this together. And I think Harry Truman can speak to something that we're going to encounter much more in the future. And the question is, what sort of experience actually makes for a good president? Or does experience even matter? I mean, a few administrations ago, election cycles ago, there was the big argument about experience. Is this candidate experienced enough to be president? With Donald Trump, now the question's mostly gone because he had no political experience. The only other president who had none was Eisenhower, and he was Supreme Allied Commander, and that's a little bit different. And now, with this recording in late February 2020, Michael Bloomberg is in the Democratic Party, and maybe he couldn't have made it this last election cycle because he was only a mayor, but now that question seems moot. So we're entering this new era where what it means to have experience is a very different thing from what it was a few election cycles ago. Harry Truman came into office without the traditional experience that many would expect of a president. So based on looking at him, comparing him to other people, what makes for a good president? I mean, is there any kind of experience, if not political experience, that you think could prepare someone to be a good president?
That's an excellent question. And I think the only way to answer it is you never know until you're looking at it and at a presidency in retrospect. It's the same sort of scenario you would say if you took, you know, an unproven quarterback. Again, I'm not a crazy football fan, but it seems like an apt metaphor, and put him in a quarterback and he's never played in the NFL and maybe he'll be great and maybe he won't. And if he's not great, you can say, he didn't have any experience. But if he is, it's inexplicable. And those inexplicable success stories are our favorite success stories because they're so unexpected. But another point I can make is that Truman, you know, he was widely seen as very obscure and very inexperienced. At the same time, he had served two terms in the Senate, and he had a pretty good understanding of how things worked on Capitol Hill. So he didn't really have a lot of executive experience, and yet he knew how power functioned in the Capitol. He knew who controlled it and how it was leveraged. So I think that that kind of stuff helped him immeasurably. But really, ultimately, his success, I think, which it was just a matter of character. He had it. And America agreed. That's why he won. But as you go forward, you know, who knows who becomes president next? And we'll never know until that presidency is over, whether that president will be a great president, a good president, bad president, and we'll all be dissecting that president for generations to come, dissecting the presidency, I should say, and, you know, coming up with our own theories of why he was or she was successful or why not.
Definitely, much like we've done here. Well, there's a lot more to unpack, but listeners can do that if they check out your book, which is Dewey Defeats Truman, the 1948 Election and the Battle for America's Soul. AJ, thank you for joining us.
It's an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much.
All right, so that is all for the episode today. As always, I'd like to kick things off by thanking the Spy Masters for History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our Spy Masters include Baron Fraza, Chris C., David Santee, The McCrays, Jake Harrington, Jennifer French Lee, Josh Reddick, Carl from Norway, Michael from New York, Nick Brooks, Rob from Chicago, Ryan Gillen, Tom from Ohio, Moondoggy from Ohio, Tyler from Colorado, and Bill Ivy. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams, where I do live versions of podcast episodes, where you can leave feedback as I'm talking, and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a 3-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on Earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.